infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I'm your host, Tracy Savage. Tonight, we have a special presentation, which we're just going to get right into because it's over an hour long, so I'm going to have to split this between tonight's episode and next week's episode with a little bit more after the continuation. But this is a presentation of Randy Pausch, who was a professor of computer science, human-computer interaction, and design at Carnegie Mellon University. You can look him up on the cmu.edu site, but we'll get to that later. From 1988 to 1997, he taught at the University of Virginia. He's an award-winning teacher and researcher and has worked with Adobe, Google, EA, which is Electronic Arts, and Walt Disney Imagineering. And he pioneered the Alice Project. He lived in Virginia with his wife and three children. Now, what's interesting about this man, and there's a lot of professors that give talks titled The Last Lecture. Professors are asked to consider their demise and to ruminate on what matters most to them. And while they speak, audiences can't help but mull the same question. What wisdom would we impart to the world if we knew it was our last chance? If we had to vanish tomorrow, what would we want as our legacy? When Randy Pausch, this computer science professor at Carnegie Mellon, was asked to give a lecture like this, he didn't have to imagine it was the last because he had been recently diagnosed with terminal cancer. The lecture he gave, called Really Achieving Your Childhood Dreams, wasn't about dying, though. It was about the importance of overcoming obstacles, of enabling the dreams of others, and seizing every moment because, as he says, time is all you have, and you may find one day that you have less than you think, unquote. It was a summation of everything Randy had come to believe, and it was about living. So you can get the book called The Last Lecture, or you can actually watch it right on YouTube. You can go to Carnegie Mellon's website, and you can see it there, and a whole bunch of other information about projects that he worked on. But we're going to jump into this. He's combined in this lecture humor, inspiration, and intelligence that made this lecture such a phenomenon that it spread like wildfire through the internet. It's still being watched, and we're going to play it just for you. So hang on, and we're going to get started. It's only going to be part. Second half is going to be next week. So enjoy Randy Pausch's Really Achieving Your Childhood Dreams.
Make me earn it. It's wonderful to be here. What Indira didn't tell you is that this lecture series used to be called The Last Lecture. If you had one last lecture to give before you died, what would it be? I thought, damn, I finally nailed the venue and they renamed it. So, you know, in case there's anybody who wandered in and doesn't know the backstory, my dad always taught me, when there's an elephant in the room, introduce them. If you look at my CAT scans, there are approximately 10 tumors in my liver, and the doctors told me 3 to 6 months of good health left. That was a month ago, so you can do the math. I have some of the best doctors in the world. So that is what it is. We can't change it, and we just have to decide how we're going to respond to that. We cannot change the cards we are dealt, just how we play the hand. If I don't seem as depressed or morose as I should be, sorry to disappoint you. And I assure you, I am not in denial. It's not like I'm not aware of what's going on. My family, my three kids, my wife, we just decamped. We bought a lovely house in Chesapeake, Virginia, near Norfolk, and we're doing that because that's a better place for the family to be down the road. And the other thing is I am in phenomenally good health right now. I mean, it's the greatest thing of cognitive dissonance you will ever see is the fact that I am in really good shape. In fact, I'm in better shape than most of you. So anybody who wants to cry or pity me can come down and do a few of those, and then you may pity me. All right, so what are we not talking about today? We're not talking about cancer, because I spent a lot of time talking about that, and I'm really not interested. If you have any herbal supplements or remedies, please stay away from me. And we're not going to talk about things that are even more important than achieving your childhood dreams. We're not going to talk about my wife, we're not talking about my kids, because I'm good, but I'm not good enough to talk about that without tearing up. So we're just going to take that off the table. That's much more important. And we're not going to talk about spirituality and religion, although I will tell you that I have experienced a deathbed conversion. I just bought a Macintosh. Now, I knew I'd get 9% of the audience with that, but... All right, so what is today's talk about then? It's about my childhood dreams and how I've achieved them. I've been very fortunate that way. How I believe I've been able to enable the dreams, I've been able to enable the dreams of others. And to some degree, lessons learned. I'm a professor. There should be some lessons learned. And how you can use the stuff you hear today to achieve your dreams or enable the dreams of others. And as you get older, you may find that enabling the dreams of others thing is even more fun. So, what were my childhood dreams? Well, you know, I had a really good childhood. I mean, no kidding around. I was going back through the family archives, and what was really amazing was I couldn't find any pictures of me as a kid where I wasn't smiling, right? And that was just a very gratifying thing. You know, there was our dog, right? Aw, thank you. And there I actually have a picture of me dreaming. And I did a lot of that, you know. There's a lot of wake ups, you know. It was an easy time to dream. I was born in 1960, right? When you're 8 or 9 years old and you look at the TV set and men are landing on the moon, anything is possible. And that's something we should not lose sight of, is that the inspiration and the permission to dream is huge. So what were my childhood dreams? You may not agree with this list, but I was there. Being in zero gravity, playing in the National Football League, authoring an article in the World Book Encyclopedia. I guess you can tell the nerds early. Being Captain Kirk. Anybody here have that childhood dream? Not at CMU, no. I wanted to become one of the guys who won the big stuffed animals in the amusement park, and I wanted to be an Imagineer with Disney. Right? These are not sorted in any particular order, although I think they do get harder, except for maybe the first one. Okay, so being in zero gravity. Now, it's important to have specific dreams. I did not dream of being an astronaut, because when I was a little kid, I wore glasses, and they told me, oh, astronauts can't have glasses. And I was like, I didn't really want the whole astronaut gig. I just wanted the floating. So, and as a child, prototype 0.0. But that didn't work so well. And it turns out that NASA has something called the Vomit Comet that they use to train the astronauts. And this thing does parabolic arcs. And at the top of each arc, you get about 25 seconds where you're ballistic, and you get about, you know, a rough equivalent of weightlessness for about 25 seconds. And there is a program where college students can submit proposals. And if they win the competition, they get to fly. And I thought that was really cool, and we had a team, and we put a team together, and they won, and they got to fly. And I was all excited because I was going to go with them. And then I hit the first brick wall, because they made it very clear that under no circumstances were faculty members allowed to fly with the teams. I know, I was heartbroken, right. I was like, but I worked so hard. And so I read the literature very carefully, and it turns out that NASA... it's part of their outreach and publicity program. And it turns out that these students were allowed to bring a local media journalist from their hometown. And Randy Pausch, web journalist. It's really easy to get a press pass. So I called up the guys at NASA and I said, I need to know where to fax some documents. And they said, what documents are you going to fax us? I said, my resignation as the faculty advisor and my application as the journalist. And he said, that's a little transparent, don't you think? And I said, yeah, but our project is virtual reality, and we're going to bring down a whole bunch of VR headsets, and all the students from all the teams are going to experience it, and all those other real journalists are going to get to film it. Jim Foley's going, ah, oh, you bastard, yes. And the guy said, here's the fax number. So, and indeed, we kept our end of the bargain, and that's one of the themes that you'll hear later on in the talk, is have something to bring to the table, right? Because that will make you more welcomed. And if you're curious about what zero gravity looks like, hopefully the sound will be working here.
It's on. All right, go get him, Mozzie. This is fantastic. It's just amazing. It's nothing like I expected. We're having a great
there
time.
There I am.
I don't think any of us have been so far. This is awesome. Ah! You got one, Mozzie, that's good.
You got a ball for you, Mozzie.
You do pay the piper at the bottom. So, childhood dream number one, check. All right, let's talk about football. My dream was to play in the National Football League. And most of you don't know that I actually play. No. No, I did not make it to the National Football League. But I probably got more from that dream and not accomplishing it than I got from any of the ones that I did accomplish. I had a coach. I signed up when I was 9 years old. I was the smallest kid in the league by far. And I had a coach, Jim Graham, who was 6'4". He had played linebacker at Penn State. He was just this hulk of a guy. And he was old school. I mean, really old school. Like, he thought the forward pass was a trick play. And he showed up for practice the first day, and, you know, this big hulking guy, we were all scared to death of him, and he hadn't brought any footballs. How are we going to have practice without any footballs? And one of the other kids said, excuse me, coach, but there's no football. And Coach Graham said, right, how many men are on a football field at a time? Somebody said, 11 on a team, 22. And Coach Graham said, all right, and how many people are touching the football at any given time? Well, one of them. And he said, right, so we're going to work on what those other 21 guys are doing. And that's a really good story because it's all about fundamentals. Fundamentals, fundamentals, fundamentals. You've got to get the fundamentals down because otherwise the fancy stuff isn't going to work. And the other Jim Graham story I have is there was one practice where he just rode me all practice. Just, you're doing this wrong, you're doing this wrong, go back and do it again, you owe me, you're doing push-ups after practice. And when it was all over, one of the other assistant coaches came over and said, yeah, Coach Graham rode you pretty hard, didn't he? I said, yeah. He said, that's a good thing. He said, when you're screwing up and nobody's saying anything to you anymore, that means they gave up. And that's a lesson that stuck with me my whole life, is that when you see yourself doing something badly and nobody's bothering to tell you anymore, that's a very bad place to be. Your critics are your ones telling you they still love you and care. After Coach Graham, I had another coach, Coach Setliff, and he taught me a lot about the power of enthusiasm. He did this one thing where only for one play at a time, he would put people in at like the most horrifically wrong position for them. Like all the short guys would become receivers, right? It was just laughable. But we only went in for one play, right? And boy, the other team just never knew what hit them. Because when you're only doing it for one play and you're just not where you're supposed to be, and freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, boy, are you going to clean somebody's clock for that one play. And that kind of enthusiasm was great. And to this day, I am most comfortable on a football field. I mean, it's just one of those things where, you know, if I'm working a hard problem, people will see me wandering the halls with one of these things. And that's just because, you know, when you do something young enough and you train for it, it just becomes a part of you. And I'm very glad that football was a part of my life. And if I didn't get the dream of playing in the NFL, that's okay. I probably got stuff more valuable. Because looking at what's going on in the NFL, I'm not sure those guys are doing so great right now. Okay? And so one of the expressions I learned at Electronic Arts, which I love, which pertains to this, is experience is what you get when you didn't get what you wanted. And I think that's absolutely lovely. And the other thing about football is we send our kids out to play football or soccer or swimming or whatever it is. And it's the first example of what I'm going to call a head fake or indirect learning. We actually don't want our kids to learn football. I mean, yeah, it's really nice that I have a wonderful three-point stance and that I know how to do a chop block and all this kind of stuff. But we send our kids out to learn much more important things: teamwork, sportsmanship, perseverance, etc., etc. And these kinds of head fake learnings are absolutely important. And you should keep your eye out for them because they're everywhere. All right, a simple one, being an author in the World Book Encyclopedia. When I was a kid, we had the World Book Encyclopedia on the shelf. For the freshmen, this is paper. We used to have these things called books. And after I had become somewhat of an authority on virtual reality, but not like a really important one, so I was at the level of people the World Book would badger, they called me up and I wrote an article, and this is Caitlin Kelleher, and there's an article, if you go to your local library where they still have copies of the World Book, look under V for virtual reality, and there it is. And all I have to say is that having been selected to be an author in the World Book Encyclopedia, I now believe that Wikipedia is a perfectly fine source for your information because I know what the quality control is for real encyclopedias. They let me in. All right, next one. At a certain point, you just realize there's some things you're not going to do, so maybe you just want to stand close to the people. My God, what a role model for young people. Right? I mean, just this is everything you want to be. And what I learned that carried me forward in leadership later is that, you know, he wasn't the smartest guy on the ship. I mean, Spock was pretty smart, and McCoy was the doctor, and Scotty was the engineer. And you sort of go, and what skill set did he have to get on this damn thing and run it? And, you know, clearly there's this skill set called leadership. And, you know, whether or not you like the series, there's no doubt that there was a lot to be learned about how to lead people by watching this guy in action. So, and he just had the coolest damn toys. Right? I mean, my God. I just thought it was fascinating as a kid that he had this thing and he could, you know, talk to the ship with it. Right? You know, I just thought that was just spectacular. And, of course, now I own one and it's smaller. So that's kind of cool. So I got to achieve this dream. James T. Kirk, his alter ego, William Shatner, wrote a book, which I think was actually a pretty cool book. It was with Chip Walter, who is a Pittsburgh-based author who's quite good. And they wrote a book on basically the science of Star Trek, you know, what has come true. And they went around to top places around the country and looked at various things, and they came here to study our virtual reality setup. And so we built a virtual reality for him. It looked something like that. We put it in, put it to red alert. He was a very good sport. It's not like he saw that one coming. And it's really cool to meet your boyhood idol. But it's even cooler when he comes to you to see what cool stuff you're doing in your lab. That was just a great moment. All right. Winning stuffed animals. This may seem mundane to you, but when you're a little kid and you see the big buff guys walking around in an amusement park and they got all these big stuffed animals, right? And this is my lovely wife. And I have a lot of pictures of stuffed animals I've won. That's my dad posing with one that I won. I've won a lot of these animals. There's my dad. He did win that one, to his credit. Right? And this was just a big part of my life and my family's life. But, you know, I can hear the cynics. You know, in this age of digitally manipulated things, maybe those bears really aren't in the picture with me. Or maybe I paid somebody $5 to take a picture in the theme park next to the bear. And I said, how in this age of cynicism can I convince people? And I said, I know. I can show them the bears. Bring them out. Thank you.
We can just put him right there. We can just put him back against the wall.
Yes, sir. Okay. Thanks, honey. So here are some bears. We didn't have quite enough room in the moving truck down to Chesapeake. And anybody who'd like a little piece of me at the end of this, feel free to come up. First come, first serve. All right, my next one, being an Imagineer. This was the hard one. Believe me, getting to zero gravity is easier than becoming an Imagineer. When I was a kid, I was 8 years old, and our family took a trip cross-country to see Disneyland. And if you've ever seen the movie National Lampoon's Vacation, it was a lot like that. It was a quest. And these are real vintage photographs. And there I am in front of the castle, and there I am. And for those of you who are into foreshadowing, this is the Alice ride. And I just thought this was just the coolest environment I'd ever been in. And instead of saying, gee, I want to experience this, I said, I want to make stuff like this. And so I bided my time, and then I graduated with my PhD from Carnegie Mellon, thinking that meant me infinitely qualified to do anything. And I dashed off my letters of application to Walt Disney Imagineering, and they sent me some of the damn nicest go-to-hell letters I've ever gotten. We have carefully reviewed your application, and presently we do not have any positions available which require your particular qualifications. Now think about the fact that you're getting this from a place that's famous for guys who sweep the street, right? So that was a bit of a setback. But remember, the brick walls are there for a reason, right? The brick walls are not there to keep us out. The brick walls are there to give us a chance to show how badly we want something. Because the brick walls are there to stop the people who don't want it badly enough. They're there to stop the other people. All right, fast forward to 1991. We did a system back at the University of Virginia called Virtual Reality on $5 a day. Just one of those unbelievable, spectacular things. I was so scared back in those days as a junior academic. Jim Foley's here, and I just love to tell this story. He knew my undergraduate advisor, Andy Van Dam, and I'm at my first conference, and I'm just scared to death. And this icon in the user interface community walks up to me and just out of nowhere just gives me this huge bear hug, and he says, that was from Andy. And that was when I thought, okay, maybe I can make it, right? You know, maybe I do belong. And a similar story is that this was just this unbelievable hit because at the time everybody needed $500,000 to do virtual reality and everybody felt frustrated, and we literally hacked together a system for about $5,000 in parts and made a working VR system. And people were just like, oh my God, it's like, you know, the Hewlett-Packard garage thing. This is so awesome. And so I'm giving this talk, and the room has just gone wild. And during the Q&A, a guy named Tom Furness, who was one of the big names in virtual reality at the time, he goes up to the microphone and he introduces himself. And I didn't know what he looked like, but I sure as hell knew the name. And he asked a question. And I was like, I'm sorry, did you say you're Tom Furness? He said, yes. I said, then I would love to answer your question, but first, will you have lunch with me tomorrow? And there's a lot in that little moment, right? There's a lot of humility, but also asking a person where he can't possibly say no. And so Imagineering, a couple of years later, was working on a virtual reality project. This was top secret. They were denying the existence of a virtual reality attraction after the time that the publicity department was running the TV commercials. Okay, so Imagineering really had nailed this one tight. And it was the Aladdin attraction where you would fly a magic carpet and the head-mounted display, sometimes known as Gator Vision. And so I had an in. As soon as the project had just, you know, they started running the TV commercials, and I had been asked to brief the Secretary of Defense on the state of virtual reality. Okay, Fred Brooks and I had been asked to brief the Secretary of Defense, and that gave me an excuse. So I called Imagineering, and I said, look, I'm briefing the Secretary of Defense. I'd like some materials on what you have, because it's one of the best VR systems in the world. And they kind of pushed back, and I said, look, is all this patriotism stuff in the parks a farce? And they're like, okay. They said, but the PR department doesn't have, this is so new, the PR department doesn't have any footage for you, so I'm going to have to connect you straight through to the team who did the work. Jackpot. Right? So I find myself on the phone with a guy named John Snoddy, who is one of the most impressive guys I have ever met. And he was the guy running this team, and it's not surprising they had done impressive things. And so he sent me some stuff. We talked briefly. He sent me some stuff. And I said, hey, I'm going to be out in the area for a conference shortly. Would you like to get together and have lunch? Translation, I'm going to lie to you and say that I have an excuse to be in the area so I don't look too anxious. But I would go to Neptune to have lunch with you. And so John said, sure. And I spent something like 80 hours talking with all the VR experts in the world, saying, if you had access to this one unbelievable project, what would you ask? And then I compiled all of that, and I had to memorize it, which anybody who knows me knows that I have no memory at all, because I couldn't go in looking like a dweeb with, you know, hi, question 72. Right? So I went in, and this was like a two-hour lunch, and John must have thought he was talking to, you know, some phenomenal person, because all I was doing was channeling Fred Brooks and Ivan Sutherland and Andy Van Damme and people like that, and Henry Fuchs. So it's pretty easy to be smart when you're parroting smart people. And at the end of the lunch with John, I sort of, as we say in the business, made the ask. And I said, you know, I have a sabbatical coming up. And he said, what's that? The beginnings of the culture clash. And so I talked to him about the possibility of coming there and working with him. And he said, well, that's really good, except, you know, you're in the business of telling people stuff, and we're in the business of keeping secrets. Right? And then what made John Snoddy John Snoddy was he said, but we'll work it out. Right? Which I really love. The other thing that I learned from John Snoddy, I could do easily an hour-long talk just on what have I learned from John Snoddy. One of the things he told me was that wait long enough and people will surprise and impress you. He said, when you're pissed off at somebody and you're angry at them, you just haven't given them enough time. Just give them a little more time and they'll almost always impress you. And that really stuck with me. I think he's absolutely right on that one. So to make a long story short, we negotiated a legal contract. It was going to be the first, some people referred to it as the first and last paper ever published by Imagineering. But the deal was I go, I provide my own funding, I go for 6 months, I work with a project, we publish a paper. And then we meet our villain. I can't be all sweetness and light because I have no credibility. Somebody's head's going to go on a stick. Turns out that the person who gets his head on the stick is a dean back at the University of Virginia. His name is not important. Let's call him Dean Wormer. And Dean Wormer has a meeting with me where I say I want to do this sabbatical thing, and I've actually gotten the Imagineering guys to let an academic in, which is insane. I mean, if John hadn't gone nuts, this would never have been a possibility. This is a very secretive organization. And Dean Wormer looks at the paperwork and he says, well, it says they're going to own your intellectual property. And I said, yeah, we got the agreement to publish the paper. There is no other IP. I don't do patentable stuff. And he says, yeah, but you might. So deal's off, and just get them to change that little clause there and then come back to me. I'm like, excuse me? And then I said to him, I want you to understand how important this is. If we can't work this out, I'm going to take an unpaid leave of absence, and I'm just going to go there, and I'm going to do this thing. And he said, hey, you know, I might not even let you do that. I mean, you've got the IP in your head already, and maybe they're going to suck it out of you, so that's not going to fly either. It's very important to know when you're in a pissing match. And it's very important to get out of it as quickly as possible. So I said to him, well, let's back off on this. Do we think this is a good idea at all? He said, I have no idea if this is a good idea, I was like, okay, well, we've got common ground there. Then I said, well, is this really your call? Isn't this the call of the dean of sponsored research, if it's an IP issue? And he said, yeah, that's true. I said, so if he's happy, you're happy? Yeah, then I'd be fine. Like Wile E. Coyote, a little. And I find myself in Gene Block's office, who's the most fantastic man in the world. And I start talking to Gene Block, and I say, let's start at the high level, since I don't want to have to back out again. So let's start at the high level. Do you think this is a good idea? He said, well, if you're asking me if it's a good idea, I don't have very much information. All I know is that one of my star faculty members is in my office, and he's really excited, so tell me more. Here's a lesson for everybody in administration. They both said the same thing. But think about how they said it. Right? I don't know. Well, I don't have much information, but one of my star faculty members is here, and he's all excited, so I want to learn more. They're both ways of saying I don't know, but boy, there's a good way and a bad way. So anyway, we got it all worked out. I went to Imagineering, sweetness and light, and all's well that ends well. Some brick walls are made of flesh. So I worked on the Aladdin project. It was absolutely spectacular. I mean, just unbelievable. Here's my nephew Christopher. This was the apparatus. You would sit on this sort of motorcycle type thing, and you would steer your magic carpet, and you would put on the head-mounted display. The head-mounted display was very interesting. It had two parts, and it was a very, very clever design. To get throughput through, the only part that touched the guest's head was this little cap, and everything else clicked onto it, all the expensive hardware. So you could replicate the caps, because they were basically free to manufacture. And this is what I really did, as I was a cap cleaner during this event. I loved Imagineering. It was just a spectacular place. Just spectacular. Everything that I had dreamed. I love the model shop. People crawling around on things the size of this room that are just big physical models. It was just an incredible place to walk around and be inspired. I'm always reminded of when I went there and people said, "Do you think the expectations are too high?" And I said, "You ever see the movie Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, where Gene Wilder says to the little boy Charlie, he's about to give him the chocolate factory, he says, 'Well, Charlie, did anybody ever tell you the story of the little boy who suddenly got everything he ever wanted?' Charlie's eyes get like saucers, and he says, 'No, what happened to him?' Gene Wilder says, 'He lived happily ever after.'" Okay, so working on the Aladdin VR, I described it as a once in every 5 years opportunity, and I stand by that assessment. It forever changed me. It wasn't just that it was good work and I got to be a part of it, but it got me into the place of working with real people and real HCI user interface issues. Most HCI people live in this fantasy world of white-collar laborers with PhDs and master's degrees, and you know, until you got ice cream spilled on you, you're not doing field work, right? And more than anything else, from John Snoddy, I learned how to put artists and engineers together, and that's been the real legacy. We published a paper, just a nice academic cultural scandal. When we wrote the paper, the guys at Imagineering said, "Well, let's do a nice big picture, like you would in a magazine." And the SIGGRAPH committee, which accepted the paper, it was like this big scandal. Are they allowed to do that? There was no rule. So we published the paper, and amazingly, since then, there's a tradition of SIGGRAPH papers having color figures on the first page. So I've changed the world in a small way. And then at the end of my 6 months, they came to me and they said, "You want to do it for real? You can stay." And I said no. One of the only times in my life I have surprised my father. He was like, "You what?" He said, "Since you were, you know, all you wanted, and now they got it, and you're like, huh?" There was a bottle of Maalox in my desk drawer. Be careful what you wish for. It was a particularly stressful place. Imagineering in general is actually not so Maalox-laden, but the lab I was in, oh, John left in the middle. And it was a lot like the Soviet Union. It was a little dicey for a while. But it worked out okay. And if they had said, "Stay here or never walk in the building again," I would have done it. I would have walked away from tenure. I would have just done it. But they made it easy on me. They said, "You can have your cake and eat it too." And I basically become a day a week consultant for Imagineering, and I did that for about 10 years. And that's one of the reasons you should all become professors. Because you can have your cake and eat it too. Okay? I went on and consulted on things like Disney Quest, so there was the Virtual Jungle Cruise, and the best interactive experience I think ever done, and Jesse Schell gets the credit for this, Pirates of the Caribbean. Wonderful at Disney Quest. And so those are my childhood dreams. And, you know, that's pretty good. I felt good about that. So then the question becomes, how can I enable the childhood dreams of others? And again, boy, am I glad I became a professor. What better place to enable childhood dreams? Maybe working at EA, I don't know. That'd probably be a good close second. But, and... This started in a very concrete realization that I could do this, because a young man named Tommy Burnett, when I was at the University of Virginia, came to me, was interested in joining my research group, and we talked about it, and he said, "Oh, and I have a childhood dream." Well, it gets pretty easy to recognize them when they tell you. And I said, "Yes, Tommy, what is your childhood dream?" He said, "I want to work on the next Star Wars film." Now, you got to remember the timing on this. Where is Tommy? Tommy is here today. What year would this have been, your sophomore year?
Oh. It was around 1993.
Are you breaking anything back there, young man? Okay, all right. So in 1993, and I said to Tommy, you know they're probably not going to make those next movies. And he said, no, they are. And Tommy worked with me for a number of years as an undergraduate and then as a staff member. And then when I moved to Carnegie Mellon, every single member of my team came from Virginia to Carnegie Mellon except for Tommy because he got a better offer. And he did indeed work on all three of those films. And then I said, well, that's nice, but, you know, one at a time is kind of inefficient. And people who know me know that I'm an efficiency freak. So I said, can I do this in mass? Can I get people turned in such a way that they can be turned on to their childhood dreams? And I created a course. I came to Carnegie Mellon, and I created a course called Building Virtual Worlds. It's a very simple course. How many people here have ever been to any of the shows? Okay, so you have some of you have an idea. For those of you who don't, the course is very simple. There are 50 students drawn from all the different departments of the university. There are randomly chosen teams, four people per team, and they change every project. A project only lasts 2 weeks, so you do something, you make something, you show something, then I shuffle the teams, you get three new playmates, and you do it again. And it's every 2 weeks, and so you do five projects during the semester. The first year we taught this course, it is impossible to describe how much of a tiger by the tail we had. I was just running the course because I wanted to see if we could do it. We had just learned how to do texture mapping on 3D graphics, and we could make stuff that looked half decent, but you know, we were running on really weak computers by current standards. But I said, I'll give it a try. And at my new university, I made a couple of phone calls, and I said, I want to cross-list this course to get all these other people. And within 24 hours, it was cross-listed in five departments. I love this university. I mean, it's just, it's the most amazing place. And I said, and the kid said, well, what content do we make? I said, hell, I don't know. You make whatever you want. Two rules, no shooting violence and no pornography. Not because I'm opposed to those in particular, but, you know, that's been done with VR, right? And you'd be amazed how many 19-year-old boys are completely out of ideas when you take those off the table. Anyway, so I taught the course. The first assignment, I gave it to them. They came back in 2 weeks, and they just blew me away. I mean, the work was so beyond literally my imagination because I'd copied the process from Imagineering's VR lab, but I had no idea what they could or couldn't do with it as undergraduates and how because their tools were weaker. And they came back in the first assignment, and they did something that was so spectacular that I literally did 10 years as a professor, and I had no idea what to do next. So I called up my mentor. I called up Andy Van Dam, and I said, Andy, I just gave a two-week assignment, and they came back and did stuff that if I'd given them a whole semester, I would have given them all A's. Sensei, what do I do? And Andy thought for a minute, and he said, you go back into class tomorrow, and you look them in the eye, and you say, guys, that was pretty good, but I know you can do better. And that was exactly the right advice, because what he said was, you obviously don't know where the bar should be, and you're only going to do them a disservice by putting it anywhere. And boy, was that good advice, because they just kept going. And during that semester, it became this underground thing. I'd walk into a class with 50 students in it, and there were 95 people in the room, because it was the day we were showing work. And people's roommates and friends and parents. I'd never had parents come to class before. It was flattering and somewhat scary. And so it snowballed, and we had this bizarre thing of, well, we got to share this. If there's anything I've been raised to do, it's to share. And I said, we got to show this at the end of the semester. We got to have a big show. And we booked this room, Maconomy. I have a lot of good memories in this room. And we booked it not because we thought we could fill it, but because it had the only AV set up that would work, because this was a zoo. Right, computers and everything. and then we filled it. And we more than filled it. We had people standing in the aisle. I will never forget the dean at the time, Jim Morris, was sitting on the stage right about there. We had to kind of scoot him out of the way. And the energy in the room was like nothing I had ever experienced before. And President Cohen, Jerry Cohen, was there, and he sensed the same thing. He later described it as like an Ohio State football pep rally, except for academics. And he came over, and he asked exactly the right question. He said, before you start, he said, I got to know, where are these people from? He said, the audience, what departments are they from? And we polled them, and it was all the departments. And I felt very good, because I had just come to campus, he had just come to campus, and my new boss had seen in a very corporal way that this is the university that puts everybody together. And that made me feel just tremendous. So we did this campus-wide exhibition. People perform down here. They're in costume. And we project just like this, and you can see what's going on. You can see what they're seeing in the head mount. There's a lot of big props. So there's a guy whitewater rafting. This is Ben and E.T. And yes, I did tell them if they didn't do the shot of the kids biking across the moon, I would fail him. That is a true story. And I thought I'd show you just... so I thought I'd show you just one world. And if we can get the lights down, if that's at all possible. No, okay, that means no. All right. All right, we'll just do our best then.
Oh, hello there. I'm lonely. Make me a world.
This on its head. Watch closely. The world doesn't want to go on to the next thing in the show. So she's ready to move on, and it's not.
What are you doing?
Can't end this now.
But there are so many other worlds that have to go.
But our world is the best world.
It was an unusual course. With some of the most brilliant, creative students from all across the campus, it just was a joy to be involved with. And they took the whole stage performance aspect of this way too seriously. And it became this campus phenomenon every year. People would line up for it. It was very flattering. And it gave kids a sense of excitement of putting on a show for people who were then excited about it. And I think that that's one of the best things you can give somebody, the chance to show them what it feels like to make other people get excited and happy. I mean, that's a tremendous gift. We always tried to involve the audience, whether it was people with glow sticks or batting a beach ball around or driving. This is really cool. This technology actually got used at the Spider-Man 3 premiere in L.A., so the audience was controlling something on the screen, so that's kind of nice. And I don't have a class picture from every year, but I dredged all the ones that I do have, and all I can say is that what a privilege and an honor it was to teach that course for something like 10 years. And all good things come to an end, and I stopped teaching that course about a year ago. People always ask me, what was my favorite moment? I don't know if you can have a favorite moment, but boy, there's one I'll never forget. This was a world with, I believe, a roller skating ninja. And one of the rules was that we performed these things live, and they all had to really work, and the moment it stopped working, we went to your backup videotape. And this was very embarrassing. So we have this ninja on stage, and he's doing this roller skating thing, and the world, it did not crash gently. And I come out, and I believe it was Steve Audio, wasn't it? Was it? Where is he? Okay, where's Steve? Ah, my man, Steve Audio. And talk about quick on your feet, right? I say, Steve, I'm sorry, but your world has crashed, and we're going to go to videotape. And he pulls out his ninja sword and says, I am dishonored! Wah! It just drops. And so I think it's very telling that my favorite moment in 10 years of this high technology course was a brilliant ad lib. And then when the videotape is done and the lights come up, he's lying there lifeless and his teammates drag him off. It was really a fantastic moment. And the course was all about bonding. People used to say, well, you know, what's going to make for a good world? I said, I can't tell you beforehand, but right before they present it, I can tell you if the world's good just by the body language. If they're standing close to each other, the world is good. All right. And BBW was a pioneering course, and I won't bore you with all the details, but it wasn't easy to do. And I was given this when I stepped down from the ETC, and I think it's emblematic. If you're going to do anything that's pioneering, you will get those arrows in the back, and you just have to put up with it. I mean, everything that could go wrong did go wrong, but at the end of the day, a whole lot of people had a whole lot of fun. When you've had something for 10 years that you hold so precious, it's the toughest thing in the world to hand it over. And the only advice I can give you is find somebody better than you to hand it to. And that's what I did. There was this kid at the VR studio way back when. And you didn't have to spend very long in Jesse Schell's orbit to go, the force is strong in this one. And one of my two greatest accomplishments, I think, for Carnegie Mellon were that I got Jessica Hodgins and Jesse Schell to come here and join our faculty. And I was thrilled when I could hand this over to Jesse. And to no one's surprise, he has really taken it up to the next notch. And the course is in more than good hands, it's in better hands. But it was just one course. And then we really took it up a notch. And we created what I would call the Dream Fulfillment Factory. Don Marinelli and I got together, and with the university's blessing and encouragement, we made this thing out of whole cloth that was absolutely insane, should never have been tried. All the sane universities didn't go near this kind of stuff, creating a tremendous opportunistic void. So the Entertainment Technology Center was all about artists and technologists working in small teams to make things. It was a 2-year professional master's degree, and Don and I were two kindred spirits. We're very different. Anybody who knows us knows that we're very different people. And we like to do things in a new way. And the truth of the matter is that we're both a little uncomfortable in academia. I used to say that I'm uncomfortable as an academic because I come from a long line of people who actually worked for a living. So, I detect nervous laughter. All right. And I want to stress, Carnegie Mellon is the only place in the world that the ETC could have happened, by far, the only place. Okay, this picture was Don's idea, okay? And we like to refer to this picture as Don Marinelli on guitar and Randy Pausch on keyboards. But we really did play up the left brain, right brain, and it worked out really well that way. Don is an intense guy. And Don and I shared an office. And at first, it was a small office. We shared an office for 6 years, right? Now, those of you who know Don know he's an intense guy, right? And you know, given my current condition, somebody was asking me, this is a terrible joke, but I'm going to use it anyway, because I know Don will forgive me. Somebody said, given your current condition, have you thought about whether you're going to go to heaven or hell? And I said, I don't know, but if I'm going to hell, I'm due 6 years for time served. But, I kid. Sharing an office with Don was really like sharing an office with a tornado, right? There was just so much energy, and you never knew which trailer was next, right? But you knew something exciting was going to happen. And there was so much energy. And I do believe in giving credit where credit is due. So in my typically visual way, right, if Don and I were to split the success for the ETC, he clearly gets the lion's share of it. He did the lion's share of the work. Okay, he had the lion's share of the ideas. It was a great teamwork. I think it was a great yin and a yang, but it was more like yin and yang. Right? And he deserves that credit, and I give it to him because the ETC is a wonderful place. And you know, he's now running it, and he's taking it global. We'll talk about that in a second. Describing the ETC is really hard, and I finally found a metaphor. Telling people about the ETC is like describing Cirque du Soleil if they'd never seen it. Sooner or later, you're going to make the mistake. You're going to say, well, it's like a circus. And then you're dragged into this conversation about, oh, how many tigers? How many lions? Right? How many trapeze acts? And that misses the whole point. So when we say we're a master's degree, we're really not like any master's degree you've ever seen. Here's the curriculum. The curriculum ended up looking like this. All I want to do is visually communicate to you that you do 5 projects in building virtual worlds, then you do 3 more. All of your time is spent in small teams making stuff. None of that book learning thing. Don and I have no patience for the book learning thing. It's a master's degree. They already spent 4 years doing book learning. Right? By now, they should have read all the books. The keys to success were that Carnegie Mellon gave us the reins. Completely gave us the reins. We had no deans to report to. We reported directly to the provost, which is great because the provost is way too busy to watch you carefully. We were given explicit license to break the mold. It was all project-based. It was intense. It was fun. And we took field trips. Every spring semester in January, we'd take all 50 students in the first-year class, and we'd take them out to shots at Pixar. We'd take them to Pixar, Industrial Light and Magic. And, of course, when you got guys like Tommy there acting as host, right, it's pretty easy to get entree to these places. So we did things very, very differently. The kind of project students would do, we did a lot of what we'd call edutainment. We developed a bunch of things with the Fire Department of New York, a network simulator for training firefighters, using video game-ish type technology to teach people useful things. That's not bad. Companies did this strange thing. They put in writing, we promise to hire your students. I've got the EA and Activision ones here. I think there are now, how many? 5? Drew knows, I bet. So there are 5 written agreements. I don't know of any other school that has this kind of written agreement with any company. And so that's a real statement. And these are multiple year things. So they're agreeing to hire people for summer internships that we have not admitted yet. That's a pretty strong statement about the quality of the program. And Don, as I said, he's crazy. And I mean that in a wonderful complimentary way. He's doing these things where I'm like, oh my God. You know, he's not here tonight because he's in Singapore, because there's going to be an ETC campus in Singapore. There's already one in Australia, and there's going to be one in Korea. So this is becoming a global phenomenon. So I think this really speaks volumes about all the other universities. It's really true that Carnegie Mellon is the only university that can do this. We just have to do it all over the world now. Okay? One of the big successes about the ETC is teaching people about focus. Oh, now I hear the nervous laughter from the students. I had forgotten the delayed shock therapy effect of these bar charts. When you're taking Building Virtual Worlds, every 2 weeks we get peer feedback. We put that all into a big spreadsheet. And at the end of the semester, you had 3 teammates per project, 5 projects. That's 15 data points. That's statistically valid. And you get a bar chart telling you on a ranking of how easy you are to work with where you stack up against your peers. Boy, that's hard feedback to ignore. Some still managed, but... but for the most part, people looked at that and went, wow, I gotta pick it up a notch. I better start thinking about what I'm saying to people in these meetings. And that is the best gift an educator can give, is to get somebody to become self-reflective. So the ETC was wonderful, but even the ETC, and even as Don scales it around the globe, it's still very labor-intensive. You know, it's not Tommy one at a time. It's not a research group 10 at a time. It's 50 or 100 at a time per campus times 4 campuses. But I wanted something infinitely scalable, right? Scalable to the point where millions or tens of millions of people could chase their dreams with something. And, you know, I guess that kind of a goal really does make me the Mad Hatter. So Alice is a project that we've worked on for a long, long time. It's a novel way to teach computer programming. Kids make movies and games. The head fake. Again, we're back to the head fakes. Best way to teach somebody something is to have them think they're learning something else. All right? I've done it my whole career. And the head fake here is that they're learning to program, but they just think they're making movies and video games. This thing has already been downloaded well over a million times. There are 8 textbooks that have been written about it. 10% of U.S. colleges are using it now. And it's not the good stuff yet. The good stuff is coming in the next version. Okay? I, like Moses, get to see the promised land, but I won't get to set foot in it. And that's okay, because I can see it, and the vision is clear. Millions of kids having fun while learning something hard.
And so, as he introduces, talking about his project Alice, which is so incredibly influential in so many areas with students. We'll talk more about that next week. We're going to have the rest of the interview next week. And if you want to look him up between now and then, Randy Pausch at Carnegie Mellon University website, cmu.edu, and just look his name up. You can see the video of this lecture in particular, and you can see some of the neat things he has, graphics that he put up on his presentation, which you only got the sound effects for here on this particular broadcast. Until then, I guess this is the sign-off for Savage Science Radio this week. Keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails to you.